everyone, to the first seminar this year of the New South Wales Adult Literacy and Numeracy Council. I'm Keiko Yaskawa. I'm the current president of the New South Wales Council. I also work at UTS, and I'll be presenting the workshop this afternoon, or this evening, or this. But before I go into the workshop, I just first like to acknowledge that we're holding this meeting on Aboriginal land, the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past and present. Welcome. So this workshop is a workshop that we publicised at the end of last year, and we postponed it till this time because there weren't, I guess a lot of people were busy at the end of the year, so I'm really glad that you were all able to come this evening, so welcome. We're going to be looking at critical mathematics and discussing together what that could mean for each of us and what we do as numeracy teachers, literacy teachers, whatever it is that we're doing. I presented this workshop, or a version of this workshop, last year at the ACAL conference. And at that workshop, because I talked too much, we didn't actually get to the practical part. So I don't want to repeat that. So this time I'm going to begin with a practical activity with you. So I'm going to get you to do something. And I'm assuming that you're all sitting with your favourite Barbie doll or Ken, whichever. You can turn them around, you can do whatever you like with them. And what we're going to be doing, first of all, is to be scaling up Barbie. What we're going to do is to think of, well, not just think about, we're actually going to do some measurements, and we're actually going to do some arithmetic to see what Barbie would look like if Barbie was the same height as you or me or somebody else in this room. Okay? So I'm hoping I made enough handouts. It's a two double-sided handout. If we could focus on this page, to start with the page with the table. So if you take one and pass it around. This is not an activity that I invented. It's an activity that some people in the United States developed. To see how mathematics, or critical mathematics, can help us to gain insight into popular culture and to give us tools to critique the images that are promoted in this case for, you know, the ideal woman, or the ideal image of a man that is, I think, projected with Barbie dolls and Kens, and I'm not sure what they are, but anyway. So what I've going to get you to do, and you can use calculators and you can use whatever resources that you have that you think will help you. And what we're going to do is, first of all, maybe we'll do this in two parts. I'm going to get maybe this half of the room to look at the top table and this half of the room to look at the bottom table. And what you're going to be first doing is making some measurements of Barbie. And so you've got tape measures, you've got rulers, and because Barbie's very petite and slim and etc., you might find that these tape measures are a bit too wide. So I've given you strings, and I'd like you to draw on your creative instincts to think about how you make measurements of Barbie's bust, waist and hips, or legs, arms, head and neck. So would you like to maybe work in pairs or threes or whatever to make a measurement? Take a bit of a break from Barbie and Kent for just a few minutes. So I'm not sure how far everyone got, but what we're trying to do was to see what Barbie or Kent or some of these other people would look like if they were the same height as us. Okay, so I'm guessing that each group picked somebody. as the person of the average height or the standard height or whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And we looked at, or you looked at,
can I borrow your body?
So we looked at how many of Barbie, in terms of Barbie's height, would make one of us in height. You got a scaling factor that way, which was something like, what did you get as a scaling factor?
We got
5.5. 5.5. So 5
and a half of
hers would give us the same height as us. And we wanted to then see if Barbie was as tall as us, what would her waist, arm length, leg length, bust, hips look like? Yeah? Who got to that sort of stage? Who can draw some conclusions from what you saw? Yeah. So that means Barbie's length, Barbie's legs would be much
longer.
Yeah. What else did you find?
The ratio was 1.095, so Barbie's arms were much shorter.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Not the real person, but and her head, the real person's head is smaller than the but Barbie's neck is much thinner. So Barbie would have this giant head.
Okay, thank you. What about the people who looked at the around measurements? Waist and
waist. Waist
is
bigger than yours. Waist.
Yeah. Any other observations?
Well, we thought that the ratio of the bust up to the to the hips was almost about right. But the waist
was much.
Was more stupid. Was distorted.
Okay. Now this is a kind of not very good attempt, but what I did was try to develop a scaled version of Barbie. And I'm not sure. Did somebody have a ballerina Barbie?
Yes.
Right. So I photocopied the back of. Well, I put Barbie in the photocopy. I magnified this Barbie several times, not quite to my height. So you can't make a direct comment. And this is what Barbie looks like at this height. So it's not quite as tall. It's much shorter than me. But the waist becomes really, you know, the proportion of her waist to the rest of her body becomes much more obvious. And I think what you were saying about, well, she's got lots of hair, but I think that, you know, head is much bigger compared to other parts of her, and I'm not sure what happened to her. Didn't photocopy very well. But so this exercise, if you like, is partly about learning about measurements, learning about multiplication, division, scaling, proportions, ratios, but it's also about using those mathematical skills to understand, to critically interpret the kind of image that we are seeing in the mass media, the popular media all the time about, you know, what a person looks like. And you know, I don't have any children, I don't have any daughters who play with Barbie dolls, but you know, some of you may, and you might wonder about, well, what kind of image do the children develop about what they should look like or what they want to look like in their adulthood? And maybe we can begin to see some of the reasons why there might be so many young women suffering from anorexia or whatever. I'm not going to claim that there's a direct correlation, but you know, these are quite extreme images that are being projected. And you know, perhaps it doesn't look so extreme when Barbie scaled down as a little, you know, attractive or a good figure or whatever, but this is just not a viable figure. Did anyone do Ken tonight?
Did you get legs or did you see him? In the top there or the bottom?
Bottom. So was Ken as realistic or unrealistic as Barbie?
Ken was much longer, yeah. So that I could see Barbie, Ken. 84.1 was... Ken was 14.5 and the real person was 79. And so there was a ratio of 1.06. Yeah. And again, that the arms of a real person were longer. Mm. And the head was also, a real person's head was smaller. And the neck was much, a little bit closer. Mm. Actually, quite almost the same. Yeah. That's the only thing. Mm.
But if the neck was the same and the head was much bigger, then you wonder how the neck is the
Could I say, Keiko,
yes.
Some people here might know that I've been a cartoonist with the Sydney Morning Herald in a previous incarnation. And there are a lot of things that can be learned from cartooning. And that is that you may recall that a cute cartoon drawing has a larger head for a smaller body. Mm-hmm. And we don't find anything wrong with that when we know it's a cartoon. Mm-hmm. But this is not really being a cartoon. Mm-hmm. The thing about the large head is that it does, it pushes buttons, because a baby's head is much larger proportionally than it's, it should be for its body. And we like that in a baby. We like a baby's head to be larger than it would be when the body catches up with the head later on in life. So because it is, we like that, we transfer some of that to the cartoon, and we have fond feelings for anything that's drawn that way. So I think some of that is going on here. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you for the insight. Okay, so to think about critical mathematics, I want now to look at models. I want to think about models as a tool for imagination. So if Barbies and Kens are models of what people should look like, then it creates images in our minds or children's minds about, maybe that's what I want to look like when I'm grown up. And mathematics is a tool for deconstructing the models, which is precisely what we did now, to say, what's going on with this model? Is it realistic? Is it unrealistic? Why is it? Well, we haven't got to the why in any great depth. But mathematics is a useful tool sometimes in deconstructing, pulling apart the model to think about what's really going on here. I want to talk a little bit about this notion of mathematical models as a script of what the world should look like, or a script that tells us how to view the world. And I guess I claim that critical mathematics is a tool for reading that script, and perhaps a tool for writing the kind of script that we want to write about what we want the world to look like. And at the end of the session, I want to throw up a question for you about whether you think that critical mathematics has a place in adult numeracy classrooms. And I think there are lots of people in this room who are practitioners who would be in a better position to answer this question than perhaps myself. So I want to first look at, with you, how models are made. And usually there's a problem that people want to solve, a problem, issue, some question in the real world. And the question might be something like, what should men and women look like? And then we might develop a mathematical model of that real world problem. And that problem and the model might be expressed in terms of proportions or scales or measurements. And then in modeling, mathematical modeling, we try out the different models. We simulate, see what happens if we did this, what happens if we did that. So we design and redesign Barbies and Kens. And then we ultimately come up with some solution to the problem we were looking at. So it might be, what should men and women look like? And the answer is this for a woman and Ken for a man, perhaps. But if we were approaching this from a critical mathematics perspective, there would be a lot of questions we would be asking. Like, you know, whose problem are we trying to solve? Who's defining the problem? And why would we want to solve this problem using mathematics rather than something else? A story, a picture, music. There are other tools for modeling the world. And who decides which maths to use and why? Are we going to do the measurements in metric or imperial? What are we going to measure? There are decisions that we consciously make, right? It doesn't happen automatically. Somebody's making the decision that we've got this problem and we're going to solve it, and we're going to solve it mathematically, and we're going to use this set of mathematical tools. No, we're not going to use those sets of mathematical tools. And somebody is going to churn out this model and fine-tune this bit, fine-tune that bit. Somebody's constantly making decisions about what this model is going to finally look like. And so these Barbies and Kens might be the solution, but we need to think about, you know, is this a viable solution? Is this a viable solution of what a person should look like? And so the question of who says this is the answer? Who's saying this solves the problem? So again, solution to whose problem? So somebody poses a problem and somebody says, we're going to use math, we're going to use this math, we're going to fiddle around until we get this solution. And often when we have a mathematical solution, people are under the impression that because it's math, it's the only answer. It doesn't matter who did the math, we're all going to get the same answer. But that's only the case if we all agree on the problem, and we all agree on the tools, and we all agree on the method, and we all agree on what constitutes a solution. So it becomes a question of whose reality are we dealing with? Whose world are we looking at when we say that, you know, this solves the problem or that solves the problem? And so critical mathematics involves asking lots of questions about solutions that might come out as a result of using mathematics. And I think there are a number of instances where that occurs, and I'll give you one other example before we finish. And critical mathematics as a tool for reading the script and writing a different script. There's several people who have been working in this area of critical mathematics, and I'm just going to name a few and the kinds of language people have been using. So there's a Dane called Ulrich Skovsmose, and he talks about, or he uses the term mathematy, which I find difficult to say. I think he saw mathematy as a parallel to literacy. And an even more difficult word to pronounce is mathericy, from Roberto D'Ambrosio. He's a Brazilian critical mathematics scholar. He uses the term mathericy. And then there's a woman called Marilyn Frankenstein from the US. Some of you might have heard her speak on the radio. She talks about critical mathematics, but she puts the two words together. She says, you know, it's about critical mathematics, not about, you know, a qualified mathematics. It's critical mathematics. And then there's others who, you know, use the term critical mathematics. Paul Ernest, he's a British guy. Brian Greer and Rico Gutstein are working in the U.S. And my former colleague Betty Johnson and I, when we were doing some work in adult numeracy, we said initially that, well, it's not numeracy unless there is that critical element in it. So we like to think that the word critical is kind of embedded in the term numeracy. And so we don't talk about critical numeracy because that's redundant. We just say, well, numeracy, it's not numeracy unless it's critical. But that's our view. But a common thread across all of these ideas of mathematics, mathematics, critical mathematics, critical mathematics, numeracy is a critique of mathematics and mathematics education that recognizes that mathematical knowledge and its application is political, that it's got to do with power relations, about whose knowledge we're dealing with, who's claiming that this is the right tool to use, this is the right answer. And that mathematics numeracy education can both challenge social injustices or further entrench social injustices. So mathematics education has a role in addressing issues of social justice. So they're the things that, I guess, tie all of those different people's work together. And this idea of mathematical models as a script is an idea that I've been sort of playing with some people in Denmark. We think that mathematical models can describe a part or an aspect of reality. So when we make measurements and we write down the measurements, those measurements describe, you know, the length of Barbie's arms or the circumference of Barbie's head. It, you know, captures parts of what we're looking at. Yeah? And it can help us to predict and imagine possibilities. So when you discovered that Barbie's head was much bigger than yours, but the neck was much thinner than yours, you can predict that, well, if I work really hard, well, I don't know how you fatten your head and lose weight along your neck, but that's probably going to be a problem, that, you know, your head's going to fall off or something. You can make predictions from those descriptions, even though they're partial descriptions. And mathematical models has particular values and worldviews inscribed, embedded, written into them. And in doing so, they direct our way of viewing the world. So when somebody says, this is how a person should look like, their values or their idea that, you know, women should have tiny waists and big butts and big hips and extra long legs is built into this model of what a person should look like, right? Which might be quite a different model or a world view or a view of what a healthy person should look like that we hold. And mathematical models or models prescribes what actions to take in response to what it allows us to see. So if somebody took this model as a valid model of what we should look like, then they think, oh, you know, I must go on a diet straight away so that my waist becomes as tiny as that. It prescribes actions, right? For people who, I guess, believe the model, accept the model, think it's a credible, viable model. And the more we see and use and accept these models, we start to subscribe to the value systems and the beliefs that are inscribed, embedded in the model. So mathematical models can be very powerful because it's more than numbers. It's got people's, you know, world views, if you like, built into them. And until we ask questions of the model, unless we deconstruct, pull it apart, we don't always see what kinds of beliefs are built into them that we're not seeing when we just look at these models on the surface. Well, Barbies aren't the only models in the world. In terms of the models that we encounter in our day-to-day lives, pay rates are based on formulae that somebody has put together as the model of how we pay casual teachers in TAFE or casual lecturers in universities or casual cleaners who come and clean buildings in the morning or in the middle of the night. Insurance policies are based on models of how long people should live, and they're also based on a model of how valuable a person's life is. So, you know, who decides that? I don't know, but somebody does. Australian Core Skills Framework is a model of what everyone needs to know. And it's not that it's absolutely true. Some people decided that that's the model of an educated person or a literacy and numeracy trained person. Budgets are models of how the money in an organization should be used. Unemployment rates, also a model, because there are definitions of who counts as being unemployed, who counts as being employed, and that model changes every time a government changes. So, you know, if you're working, you know, sometimes if you're working 20 hours a week, you're employed. At another time, if you're working 1 hour in the week, you're employed. You're not an unemployed person if you're working even a tiny bit. So there are models where people decide what is who is an unemployed person, who is an employed person. Industrial awards are also models of how people should work and how they should be rewarded. And so I want to show you a sort of work in progress at one level of how critical mathematics was used to develop and partially win a union campaign. And this was for casual academics in a very casualized university in Australia. And a couple of colleagues and I got some money from the union to research the lived experiences of casual academics in this particular university. Because there were a number of casual academics who were very unhappy. So we were looking at a situation of a highly casualized higher education workplace, where there was discontent among many casual staff about their working conditions. And they felt that the pay they were getting didn't reflect the hours involved in the delivery, the preparation, the marking, student consultations, and all the kinds of things that they had to do their job. And they felt that the pay rate didn't reflect that. And so one of the things that we did, and the three of us who did this research project were also union officers in the branch of this university, that shall remain nameless. And so part of what we did was to unpack their actual award for them. So we pulled out the enterprise agreement and we demystified their contract for them. So we pulled out bits of the enterprise agreement which explained what they were being paid for So for a basic lecture, when you give 1 hour of lecture, you're actually being paid for the hour of delivery and 2 hours of what they call associated non-contact duties. So for a basic lecture, at the moment at UTS, you get paid around $143. It might have gone up a bit since this one. But that 143 hours is payment not just for the 1 hour you're in the classroom, but the 1 hour you're in the classroom plus 2 hours of non-contact hours of associated work, which might involve going to the library to do some research on the topic that you're teaching, or talking to students who want some help in their assignments. It might even involve a bit of marking, and so on. And so when we unpacked what the contract really meant, the casual started to say, well, actually, this pay rate doesn't work. So, what's maths got to do with it? We looked at the numeracy of casual employment, so we were deconstructing the actual pay structure, examining what the pay rate actually means and what people are actually being paid for. So we got them to look at their own work patterns. How many hours were they spending talking to students outside class time, preparing their lectures, doing marking, sending emails, doing the website stuff. And we asked them to keep a log, so that they actually kept a log of how many hours they were spending for preparation, marking, consultation, and so on. And then we had some data to compare what they were being paid for and what they were not being paid for, how many hours of unpaid work they were actually doing. And we found that there was commonality, that all the tutors we were talking to were spending far more than the 2 hours of associated non-contact hours for every hour of lecture. So they were spending many more hours in preparation, many more hours consulting students. And so there was a pattern which then enabled us as a union to pull together a claim for the unpaid work. They didn't pay for everything, but we got an increase in how much they were getting paid for the various bits and pieces they were doing. So that's one part of critical mathematics, of actually understanding the maths that's defining their working conditions and pay rates. But there was another dimension to this campaign that I think involved critical mathematics or critical numeracy. And that wasn't so much about educating the casual lecturers, it was about educating the union officials who were, until then, very reluctant to worry about casual academics. Although casual academics only pay a tiny membership fee, they come and go. So, you know, we need to focus on the full-time academics in the academy. And, of course, when you look at our union structure, the people who dominate the leadership positions are full-time academics. And so we, in order to get them to pay attention to the casuals' claims, we did some numeracy to put the argument that it's actually in the interest of the union to start paying attention to the casuals' cause. And it had to do with the politics of casualization. So we looked at, you know, what priority has casuals' academic pay and conditions had in the union? Very low. Who in the union has been negotiating pay and conditions on behalf of casuals? Full-time academics holding leadership positions. But what is the ratio of casual academics to full-time academics in the sector? Well, casuals are growing. Full-times are declining. right? There are more casuals in terms of headcount in the academy than full-time academics. Universities are not replacing full-time academics at the same time, at the same rate that they're leaving the sector, retiring. If we look at the union membership, and this research was done in the latter half of the Howard government era, so union membership was declining across all unions, including our union. So when union membership declines, union resources decline. So the union was in a bit of a crisis. So they had to think about, what's happening with the union membership now? And so we put to them, can the union afford not to organize and recruit the casual academics? And they realized that, well, if the casuals are growing and the full-time members are declining, well, unless we start to recruit the casuals and get the membership fee, which adds to the resources of the union, but also if the academy is getting casualized and the casuals are not members and the small minority of full-timers are members, the university can basically persuade the casuals to accept certain conditions that might not be in the interest of the full-time academics. So we needed to engage the casuals in our union so we can put together a collective front in terms of what we want in the university to look like. And then for the casuals themselves, as I'm sure many of you know, when you're a casual precarious worker, you come and go. You're not really part of the culture of the workplace. You're not included in, you know, all the decision-making in the workplace, so you can feel very isolated and marginalized. And the only way to get yourself heard is to act collectively with the other casuals. And so we put that to the casual academics to work collectively. And we made some headways. We did a report called Getting the Best of You for Nothing. It was actually Getting the Best of You for Bugger All, which was the quote from an actual casual. And we got the casuals' voices heard in the union and through that in the academy, and small changes, not radical changes, started to occur. So I think critical mathematics education is partly about, you know, learning, understanding, demystifying the math, but also using the math to understand the power relations, the political power that's involved in defining the model that's working, well, in this case, in the workplace. So I have a bit of a play. I'm sharing things that I'm fiddling around with. I was looking at whether critical mathematics has a place in education for work, because in the current adult numeracy and literacy policy context, everything is about developing a more skilled workforce. So where does numeracy come into it? And I think there's maths or numeracy that we might be involved in to enable learners to access training and qualifications. So it might be, you know, getting our learners to school certificate level in some aspects of maths or numeracy, so that when they go into the technical maths for doing the job, like calculating area for a floor or some wall space if they're tilers, they've already met the concept of area and they have some idea of what area is and how you calculate it. And then there's also the, if you like, the functional maths for being a paid worker. So being able to, you know, check your pay slip, do your tax, bank your pay, accessing your entitlements, whether it's leave or workers' comp or overtime and so on. But then there's critical mathematics that can help workers read the politics of the workplace, to understand the logic of the pay rates in the workplace. So they've announced a 3% pay increase for the organization. But what does a 3% pay increase mean for the casual worker at the bottom of the scale and the senior executive? 3% means different things to those two groups of workers. Questioning the data that employers give about the link between workplace productivity and pay. So they say, you know, we need a more skilled workforce because we want to increase productivity. Well, how are they measuring productivity? How are they measuring skills? Looking at analyzing the political representation of different groups of workers in the workplace and how that's influencing how much voice one has or doesn't have. And also, like what we did in the casuals campaign, analyzing the political representation of different groups in the union, who is supposed to be the voice of the union, of the workers. So, I guess the question I put to you is whether you think critical mathematics has a place in the adult numeracy classroom. And I think I'll open it up to you for comments, suggestions, challenges.
Budget?
Yes. So, do you teach budgets in your adult numeracy classroom? Anyone look at budgets or work with budgets? Is that something that
I might be, because I'm doing it very quickly.
So you're looking at household budgets?
That's what budgets and Australian currency as well.
And how does critical mathematics come into teaching anything about budgets?
Could it be just a basic comparison, like am I paying too much for my groceries? Like comparing, you know, shopping at one supermarket to shopping at another?
Or costing.
Cost of fast food versus other foods. I think also questioning what we're told, like at the moment is the Coles, so we've got the campaign about the pricing and we're saying no matter where you shop. And I normally live in a small rural community and I know for a fact there's a huge cost between my groceries and Sydney groceries. Petrol, another one. So compare the particularly if you take the political context where we are told that politically, you know, these consumer watchdogs, petrol prices, you have Price Watch, it's the cheapest price, it's not the cheapest price. Might be for some people, but not for everybody. So that's the political part of critical university, the question that you're told.
Maybe also when looking at grocery prices, you see on the shelf the Coles brand orange juice is $1.80 for 2 litres and the Golden Circle is $2.80 or $2.70. So why is that? How can the same product, or virtually the same product, be so different? And what? And they're looking into what the primary producer gets paid for those oranges.
Would you look at whether things were Australian
made or coming from, like it's a bit cheaper if it's coming from overseas, or whether it's worth paying a bit more for Australian made to keep jobs? And would you look at that?
Okay. So, where does our money go? Is a really important political, critical question to be asking. Is it about just our immediate gain, or is it, do we look at it as, some sort of investment in the sustainability of our economy and jobs in our country? Yeah, the whole concept of money and value is something that would be interesting to unpack.
what is something really worth is a good question for us, especially when you get into, say, the purchase of artworks or something like that. I have an exercise I do with my numeracy group where we, I won't say deconstruct, but we look very closely at a Woolworths shopper docket. And if you've ever seen one of those things, I don't think, I've never really looked at it until I sat down and looked at it with my class. It's loaded with information.
Mm-hmm.
Even the name of the store manager is there, and her phone number, and the date, right down to the second that the purchase was made, is down there. Everything's there. All the GST on is indicated, and so there's a heap of information on it. And of course, we throw them away, don't we? But if you stop to look, there's a big chance for a lesson there if you're in the business.
Anyone else? Do some critical
mathematics? Yeah, I'm very tempted in the teacher. But yesterday we were looking at RCA 6, 1908, casualty, fatality. And there was a huge spike in fatalities in the 70s. So we then extracted the reasons why there was going to be a lot of people. The council has realised for about the last 20 years that it's sort of plateaued, and a lot of fatalities is actually sort of fairly constant. And one of the right sparks said, why are we continuing to do this? And the three families keep proliferating. And it's a real, I think it's broken up, I think, but at the beginning of.
You know,
I was sort of
asking questions,
why are
so down the same country if there's not a lot of difference? Mm. And maybe it's because we still do those things that there isn't a lot of difference.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that you might work out.
Yeah. But there's a little bit of research now happening in Germany that they have a much lower fatality rate than we do. What are they doing there?
I know in Holland they educate them. They don't find them. They pull people up who are speeding or driving dangerously and start giving them a little lecture.
Right.
And it's really effective.
So I think one of the things that critical mathematics allows us to do, or in a sense forces us to do, is to open up our numeracy class into learning more about the wider world, what's going on in the world, what's influencing different things. And I guess it then touches on, well, you know, what is it that we believe we are doing? Is it about just educating people with, you know, how to do arithmetic or how to make measurements, or is our role to educate well-rounded, but you know, a socially aware, critically aware citizen? And you know, that's, I think that's a question that only we can answer individually. But I think if we are interested in educating people to be active citizens, critical citizens, participating in different ways in society, then I think critical mathematics offers us an opportunity to do that.
I think you're right, Kate, and you reminded me that the kind of students that I've been seeing in numeracy classes for the last 12 years has been the sort of student that receives the culture without a lot of questioning, not because they're a different type of person, but because they don't have, as you would say, the tools for questioning. And they also don't believe they have the right to question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I sit down in front of the television often, and you can see a real agenda going on there if you take the time to watch it. It's almost like a conspiracy, of course it is, but it's...
All right.
Everybody seems to be wanting the same kind of outcome from the viewership. Same sort of responses. Like containers on a container vessel, it's much easier if they all buck together and lock in together and they're all the same size. So I think that if you can, even if the student doesn't walk away from a year with you with a heightened ability to calculate in that textbook way, if they walk away with the feeling that I have the right to question and I know how I might ask my first question, I think that's a better contribution that you can make.
Brian might like to show them the letter to the editor in the Wentworth Courier today, where someone is saying that someone in the eastern suburbs is distributing a letter, putting it into postboxes, saying 400,000 migrants into Australia in the last 2 years, 400,000 jobs lost in the last 2 years. Go figure. No other information than that is given. And this person took the time to write to the Wentworth Courier to say where do they get their figures from and how dare they do this. But it would be interesting if once you start going into things like that, where do people get their information from? How do they skew the ABS statistics? And then, of course, you get a conspiracy theory that can come out of it.
They've probably got it off the internet, didn't they?
And of course, according to our Minister for Education, Employment and Workplace Relations, who told us...
Julia.
On Friday, there was some of you may have heard this, there was a launch of Skills Australia's Workforce Future Strategy, and we were told by the head of Skills Australia, Andrew Gillard, that the reason why we have unemployment and skills shortage is because so many adult Australians have poor literacy and numeracy. But it was an exciting week for Australia last week because they introduced a national curriculum, and now that's getting rolled out, in a few years' time, no more adult literacy or numeracy problems.
And I'm calling to you in Auburn, having been in college.
And Tranby has had their literacy funding cut.
I work in outreach in TAFE, and we work with the most marginalised people in the community. Many have literacy, numeracy, language and communication needs, and our curriculum centre has given us a 15 hour literacy unit, so that should be enough. A 15 hour.
So, and critical literacy and numeracy is core to the delivery of outreach, and a couple of those examples that have come up are things that my teachers come back and tell me. So a group of women who someone's come in with a credit card and she finds fairly quickly that not many of them know very much about credit cards at all, and that in their community there are a lot of gambling problems, and that in fact the husband's name's on the credit card as well, and then pay slips. So a lot of them work, but they don't get pay slips and they don't understand. So they have a couple of full lessons on that. So using that critical literacy approach is really core to what we do.
Mobile phone plan.
I was thinking about exactly the same thing. Some students have mobile phone plans without really knowing what they've entered into.
Well, I have trouble understanding
that. So it looks like amongst us there are lots of good ideas about how we can include critical numeracy and critical literacy in the work we do. And I just want to finish off with a couple of things. One is that even though, Julia Gillard and Phil Bullock's analysis of unemployment and skill shortage was something that some of us would question and challenge, what it does seem to mean is that there is going to be a lot of money being put into adult literacy and numeracy over the next few years. And I think one of the things that all of us need to think about is how we're going to influence where that money goes and how that's going to be spent. I think there will be a process of developing whether it's a policy or a strategy for adult literacy and numeracy in the coming months. And I think it's important that, you know, everybody in here, you know, stays tuned in to what's happening and hopefully not just tuned in, but contributing to that debate. Because I think one of the things that we need to avoid is, complacency taking, not that there's much to take for granted anymore, but one of the things that we experienced in last year or the year before is the threat to the reading and writing hotline. If you remember the last time we met, we were trying to save the hotline, and thanks to all of the letters that many of you wrote to the ministers and other lobbying that you did, we were able to save the hotline. But we need to continue to stay active and to make sure that the hotline stays as effective as it has been. And I just want to take, you know, this opportunity where we've got people from New South Wales here to acknowledge the work of Pam Osmond, who's sitting in the back, who coordinated the hotline during last year, during a period of a great deal of uncertainty about what was going to happen to the hotline. And I think it's the work of Pam and her team and the people before Pam, Steve Goldberg and others, who, you know, was crucial in helping us put the arguments to keep the hotline going. And, you know, there are new developments in the hotline that we have to continue to battle with. So there are things that we need to continue to be aware of and to fight to improve. But if we just sit back, things are going to get worse. So I'll leave it at that. And just to thank everyone for coming. And we want to continue to hold these seminars. So if you have any suggestions of the kinds of workshops that you think would be useful for you, or if you'd like to offer to present a workshop, if you could let, and I'll introduce the members of the Council of Executives. So Vicky is our Vice President, Pam is our Treasurer, and Steve is our New South Wales Representative to the Australian Council of Adult Literacy, that's the National Peak Body, and Sue Roy and Desiree and Janet are also on the committee. So any suggestions you have about, you know, what we can do to make the council, you know, work for you, we'd be very happy to have suggestions. And we're also planning to hold a national conference at the end of the year, a one-day conference. So any suggestions about, you know, what we should be doing there, we'd really welcome that. So we might complete the sort of formal part of the workshop, and I invite you to have some drinks and mingle and